Blue Mars, Cassette 3.
To weather. This whole world was weathering. The first printed use of the word with that meaning had appeared in a book on Stonehenge, appropriately enough, in 1665. The weathering of so many centuries of years. On this stone world. Weathering. Language as the first science, exact yet vague, or multivalent. Throwing things together, the mind as weather, or being weathered. There were clouds coming up over the nearby hillocks to the west, their bottoms resting on a thermal layer as levelly as if pressing down on glass. Streamers like spun wool led the way east. Sax stood up and climbed out of the pool's depression. Out of the shelter of the hole, the wind was shockingly strong. In it, the cold intensified as if an ice age had struck full force that very second. Wind chill factor, of course. If the temperature was 262 K and the wind was blowing at about 70 kilometers an hour, with gusts much stronger, then the wind chill factor would create a temperature equivalent of about 250 K. Was that right? That was very cold indeed to be out without a helmet. And in fact, his hands were going numb, his feet as well, and his face was already without feeling, like a thick mask at the front of his head. He was shivering, and his blinks tended to stick together. His tears were freezing. He needed to get back to his car. He plodded over the rockscape, amazed at the power of the wind to intensify cold. He hadn't experienced wind chill like this since childhood, if then, and had forgotten how frigid one became. Staggering in the blasts, he climbed onto a low swell of the ancient lava and looked upslope. There was his rover, big, vivid green, gleaming like a spaceship, about 2 kilometers up the slope. A very welcome sight. But now snow began to fly horizontally past him, giving a dramatic demonstration of the wind's great speed. Little granular pellets clicked against his goggles. He took off toward the rover, keeping his head down and watching the snow swirl over the rocks. There was so much snow in the air that he thought his goggles were fogging up, but after a painfully cold operation to wipe the insides, it became clear that the condensation was actually out in the air. Fine snow. Mist. Dust. It was hard to tell. He plodded on. The next time he looked up, the air was so thick with snow that he couldn't see all the way to the rover. Nothing to do but press on. It was lucky the suit was well insulated and sewn through with heating elements, because even with the heat on at its highest power, the cold was cutting against his left side as if he were naked to the blast. Visibility extended now something like 20 meters, shifting rapidly depending on how much snow was passing by at the moment. He was in an amorphously expanding and contracting bubble of whiteness, which itself was shot through with flying snow, and what appeared to be a kind of frozen fog or mist. It seemed likely he was in the storm cloud itself. His legs were stiff. He wrapped his arms around his torso, his gloved hands trapped in his armpits. There was no obvious way of telling if he was still walking in the right direction. It seemed like he was on the same course he had been when visibility had collapsed, but it also seemed like he had gone a long way toward the rover. There were no compasses on Mars. There were, however, APS systems in his wrist pad and back in the car. He could call up a detailed map on his wrist pad and then locate himself and his car on it, then walk for a while and track his positions, then make his way directly toward the car. That seemed like a great deal of work, which brought it to him that his thinking, like his body, was being affected by the cold. It wasn't that much work, after all. So he crouched down in the lee of a boulder and tried the method. The theory behind it was obviously sound, but the instrumentation left something to be desired. The wrist pad screen was only 5 centimeters across, so small that he couldn't see the dots on it at all well. Finally, he spotted them, walked a while, and took another fix. but unfortunately his results indicated that he should be hiking at about a right angle to the direction he had been going. This was unnerving to the point of paralysis. His body insisted that it had been going the right way. His mind, part of it anyway, was pretty certain that it was better to trust the results on the wrist pad and assume that he had gotten off course somewhere. But it didn't feel that way. The ground was still at a slope that supported the feeling in his body. The contradiction was so intense that he suffered a wave of nausea, the internal torque twisting him until it actually hurt to stand, as if every cell in his body was twisting to the side against the pressure of what the wrist pad was telling him. The physiological effects of a purely cognitive dissonance. It was amazing. It almost made one believe in the existence of an internal magnet in the body, as in the pineal glands of migrating birds, but there was no magnetic field to speak of. Perhaps his skin was sensitive to solar radiation to the point of being able to pinpoint the sun's location, even when the sky was a thick dark gray everywhere. It had to be something like that, because the feeling that he was properly oriented was so strong. Eventually, the nausea of the disorientation passed, and in the end he stood and took off in the direction suggested by the wrist pad, feeling horrible about it, listing a little uphill just to try to make himself feel better. But one had to trust instruments over instincts. That was science. And so he plodded on, traversing the slope, shading somewhat uphill, clumsier than ever. His nearly insensible feet ran into rocks that he didn't see, even though they were directly beneath him. He stumbled, time after time. It was surprising how thoroughly snow could obscure the vision. After a while, he stopped and tried again to locate the rover by APS, and his wrist pad map suggested an entirely new direction, behind him and to the left. It was possible he had walked past the car. Was it? He didn't want to walk back into the wind. But now that was the way to the rover, apparently. So he ducked his head down into the biting cold and persevered. His skin was in an odd state, itching under the heating elements crisscrossing his suit, numb everywhere else. His feet were numb. It was hard to walk. There was no feeling in his face. Clearly frostbite was in the offing. He needed shelter. He had a new idea. He called up Aeonia on Pavonis and got her almost instantly.
Sax, where are you?
That's what I'm calling about, he said. I'm in a storm on Dedalia, and I can't find my car. I was wondering if you would look at my APS and my rovers and see if you can tell me which direction I should go. He put the wrist pad right against his ear.
Kawow, Sax!
It sounded like Aeonia was shouting, too, bless her. Her voice was an odd addition to the scene.
Just a second, let me check. Okay, there you are. And your car, too. What are you doing so far south? I don't think anyone can get to you very quickly, especially if there's a storm.
There is a storm, Sax said. That's why I called.
Okay, you're about 350 meters to the west of your car.
Directly west?
And a little south. But how will you orient yourself?
Sax considered it. Mars's lack of a magnetic field had never struck him as such a problem before, but there it was. He could assume the wind was directly out of the west, but that was just an assumption.
Can you check the nearest weather stations and tell me what direction the wind is coming from? He said. Sure, but it won't be much good for local variations. Here, just a second, I'm getting some help here from the others.
A few long, icy moments passed.
The wind is coming from west-northwest, Sax. So you need to walk with the wind at your back and a touch to your left.
I know. Be quiet now until you see what course I'm making and then correct it. He walked again, fortunately almost downwind. After 5 or 6 painful minutes, his wrist beeped. Aeonia said,
You're right on course.
This was encouraging, and he carried on with a bit more speed, though the wind was penetrating through his ribs right to his core.
Okay, Sax. Sax?
Yes.
You and your car are right on the same spot.
But there was no car in view. His heart thudded in his chest. Visibility was still some 20 meters, but no car. He had to get shelter fast.
Walk in an ever-increasing spiral from where you are,
the little voice on the wrist was suggesting. A good idea, in theory, but he couldn't bear to execute it. He couldn't face the wind. He stared dully at his black plastic wrist pad console. No more help to be had there. For a moment, he could make out snowbanks off to his left. He shuffled over to investigate and found that the snow rested in the lee of a shoulder-high escarpment, a feature he didn't remember seeing before, but there were some radial breaks in the rock caused by the Tharsis rise, and this must be one of them, protecting a snowbank. Snow was a tremendous insulator, though it had little intrinsic appeal as shelter. But Sax knew mountaineers often dug into it to survive nights out. It got one out of the wind. He stepped to the bottom of the snowbank and kicked it with one numb foot. It felt like kicking rock. Digging a snow cave seemed out of the question, but the effort itself would warm him a bit, and it was less windy at the foot of the bank. So he kicked and kicked and found that underneath a thick cake of wind slab there was the usual powder. A snow cave might be possible after all. He dug away at it.
Sax! Sax! Cried the voice from his wrist. What are you doing?
Making a snow cave, he said. A bivouac.
Oh, Sax, we're flying in help. We'll be able to get in next morning no matter what, so hang on. We'll keep talking to you.
Fine. He kicked and dug. On his knees, he scooped out hard, granular snow, tossing it into the swirling flakes flying over him. It was hard to move, hard to think. He bitterly regretted walking so far from the rover, then getting so absorbed in the landscape around that ice pond. It was a shame to get killed when things were getting so interesting. Free, but dead. There was a little hollow in the snow now, through an oblong hole in the wind slab. Wearily, he sat down and wedged himself back into the space, lying on his side and pushing back with his boots. The snow felt solid against the back of his suit, and warmer than the ferocious wind. He welcomed the shivering in his torso, felt a vague fear when it ceased. Being too cold to shiver was a bad sign. Very weary, very cold. He looked at his wrist pad. It was 4 p.m. He had been walking in the storm for just over 3 hours. He would have to survive another 15 or 20 hours before he could expect to be rescued, or perhaps in the morning the snow would have abated and the location of the rover become obvious. One way or another, he had to survive the night by huddling in a snow cave. Or else venture out again and find the rover. Surely it couldn't be far away. But until the wind lessened, he couldn't bear to be out looking for it. He had to wait in the snow cave. Theoretically, he could survive a night out, though at the moment he was so cold it was hard to believe that. Night temperatures on Mars still plummeted drastically. Perhaps the storm might lessen in the next hour, so that he could find the rover and get to it before dark. He told Aeonia and the others where he was. They sounded very concerned, but there was nothing they could do. He felt irritation at their voices. It seemed many minutes before he had another thought. When one was chilled, blood flow was greatly reduced to the limbs. Perhaps that was true for the cortex as well, the blood going preferentially to the cerebellum where the necessary work would continue right to the end. More time passed. Near dark, it appeared. Should call out again. He was too cold. Something seemed wrong. Advanced age, altitude, CO2 levels, some factor or combination of factors was making it worse than it should be. He could die of exposure in a single night. Appeared, in fact, to be doing just that. Such a storm. Loss of the mirrors, perhaps. Instant ice age. Extinction event. The wind was making odd noises, like shouts. Powerful gusts, no doubt. Like faint shouts howling, "Sacks! Sacks! Sacks!"
Had they flown someone in? He peered out into the dark storm, the snowflakes somehow catching the late light and tearing overhead like dim white static. Then, between his ice-crusted eyelashes, he saw a figure emerge out of the darkness, short, round, helmeted.
"Sacks!"
The sound was distorted. It was coming from a loudspeaker in the figure's helmet. Those Da Vinci techs were very resourceful people. Sacks tried to respond and found he was too cold to speak. Just moving his boots out of the hole was a stupendous effort. But it appeared to catch this figure's eye because it turned and strode purposefully through the wind, moving like a skillful sailor on a bouncing deck, weaving this way and that through the slaps of the gusts. The figure reached him and bent down and grabbed Sacks by the wrist, and he saw its face through the faceplate as clear as through a window. It was Hiroko. She smiled her brief smile and hauled him up out of his cave, pulling so hard on his left wrist that his bones creaked painfully.
"Ow!"
he said. Out in the wind, the cold was like death itself. Hiroko pulled his left arm over her shoulder and, still holding hard to his wrists just above the wrist pad, she led him past the low escarpment and right into the teeth of the gale.
"My rover is near," he mumbled, leaning hard on her and trying to move his legs fast enough to make steady plants of the foot. "So good to see her again. A solid little person. Very powerful as always."
"It's over here," she said through her loudspeaker. "You were pretty close."
"How did you find me?"
"We were tracking you as you came down Arcia. Then today, when the storm hit, I checked you out and saw you were out of your rover. After that, I came out to see how you were doing."
"Thanks."
"You have to be careful in storms."
Then they were standing before his rover. She let go of his wrist and it throbbed painfully. She bonked her faceplate against his goggles.
"Go on in," she said.
He climbed carefully up the steps to the rover's locked door, opened it, fell inside. He turned clumsily to make room for Hiroko, but she wasn't in the door. He leaned back out into the wind, looked around. No sight of her. It was dusk. The snow now looked black.
"Hiroko!"
he cried. No answer. He closed the locked door, suddenly frightened. Oxygen deprivation. He pumped the lock, fell through the inside door into the little changing room. It was shockingly warm, the air a steamy blast. He plucked ineffectively at his clothes, made no progress. He went at it more methodically. Goggles and face mask off. They were coated with ice.
Ah!
Possibly his air supply had been restricted by ice in the tube between tank and mask. He sucked in several deep breaths, then sat still through another bout of nausea, pulled off his hood, unzipped the suit. It was almost more than he could do to get his boots off. Then the suit. His underclothes were cold and clammy. His hands were burning as if on fire. It was a good sign, proof that he wasn't substantially frostbitten. Nevertheless, it was agony. His whole skin began to buzz with the same inflamed pain. What caused that? Return of blood to capillaries? Return of sensation to chilled nerves? Whatever it was, it hurt almost unbearably.
Ow!
He was in excellent spirits. It wasn't just that he had been spared from death, which was nice, but that Hiroko was alive. Hiroko was alive! It was incredibly good news. Many of his friends had assumed all along that she and her group had slipped away from the assault on Sabashi, moving through that town's mound maze back out into their system of hidden refuges. But Sacks had never been sure. There was no evidence to support the idea,
and there were elements in the security forces perfectly capable of murdering a group of dissidents and disposing of their bodies. This, Sax had thought, was probably what had happened. But he had kept this opinion to himself and reserved judgment. There had been no way of knowing for sure. But now he knew. He had stumbled into Hiroko's path, and she had rescued him from death by freezing, or asphyxiation, whichever came first. The sight of her cheery, somehow impersonal face, her brown eyes, the feel of her body supporting him, her hand clamped over his wrist. He would have a bruise because of that. Perhaps even a sprain. He flexed his hand, and the pain in his wrist brought tears to his eyes. It made him laugh. Hiroko! After a time, the fiery return of sensation to his skin banked down. Though his hands felt bloated and raw, and he didn't have proper control of his muscles or his thoughts, he was basically getting back to normal, or something like normal.
Sax! Sax! Where are you? Answer us, Sax!
Hello there. I'm back in my car.
You found it? You left your snow cave?
Yes, I saw my car in the distance through a break in the snow. They were happy to hear it. He sat there, barely listening to them babble, wondering why he had spontaneously lied. Somehow, he wasn't comfortable telling them about Hiroko. He assumed that she would want to stay concealed. Perhaps that was it. Covering for her. He assured his associates that he was all right and got off the phone. He pulled a chair into the kitchen and sat on it, warmed soup and drank it in loud slurps, scalding his tongue. Frostbitten, scalded, shaky, slightly nauseous, once weeping, mostly stunned. Despite all this, he was very, very happy. Sobered by the close call, of course, and embarrassed or even ashamed at his ineptitude, staying out, getting lost, and so on, all very sobering indeed, and yet still he was happy. He had survived, and even better, so had Hiroko. Meaning no doubt that all of her group had survived with her, including the half-dozen of the first 100 who had been with her from the beginning, Iwao, Jean, Raya, Raoul, Ellen, Evgenia. Sax ran a bath and sat in the warm water, adding hotter water slowly as his body core warmed, and he kept returning to that wonderful realization. A miracle. Well, not a miracle, of course, but it had that quality of unexpected and undeserved joy. When he found himself falling asleep in the bath, he got out, dried off, limped on sensitive feet to his bed, crawled under the coverlet, and fell asleep, thinking of Hiroko. Of making love with her in the baths in Zygote, in the warm, relaxed lubriciousness of their bathhouse trysts, late at night, when everyone else was asleep. Of her hand clamped on his wrist, pulling him up. His left wrist was very sore. And that made him happy. The next day he drove back up the great southern slope of Arcia, now covered with clean white snow, to an amazingly high altitude, 10.4 kilometers above the datum, to be exact. He felt a strange mix of emotions, unprecedented in their strength and flux, although they somewhat resembled the powerful emotions he had felt during the synaptic stimulus treatment he had taken after his stroke, as if sections of his brain were actively growing. The limbic system, perhaps, the home of the emotions, linking up with the cerebral cortex at last. He was alive. Hiroko was alive. Mars was alive. In the face of these joyous facts, the possibility of an ice age was as nothing. A momentary swing in a general warming pattern, something like the almost forgotten Great Storm. Although he did want to do what he could to mitigate it,
Meanwhile, in the human world, there were still fierce conflicts going on everywhere, on both worlds. But it seemed to Sax that the crisis had somehow gotten beyond war. Flood, ice age, population boom, social chaos, revolution. Perhaps things had gotten so bad that humanity had shifted into some kind of universal catastrophe rescue operation, or, in other words, the first phase of the post-capitalist era. Or maybe he was just getting overconfident, buoyed by the events on Deidalia Planitia. His Da Vinci associates were certainly very worried. They spent hours on screen telling him every little thing about the arguments ongoing in East Pavonis. But he had no patience for that. Pavonis was going to become a standing wave of argument, it was obvious. And the Da Vinci crowd, worrying so, that was simply them. At Da Vinci, if someone even raised his voice 2 decibels, people worried that things were getting out of control. No. After his experience on Deidalia, these things simply weren't interesting enough to engage him. Despite the encounter with the storm, or perhaps because of it, he only wanted to get back out into the country. He wanted to see as much of it as he could, to observe the changes wrought by the removal of the mirrors, to talk to various terraforming teams about how to compensate for it. He called Nano in Sabishi and asked him if he could come visit and talk it over with the university crowd. Nano was agreeable. "Can I bring some of my associates?" Sax asked. Nano was agreeable. And all of a sudden, Sax found he had plans, like little Athenas jumping out of his head. What would Hiroko do about this possible ice age? That he couldn't guess. But he had a large group of associates in the labs at Da Vinci who had spent the last decades working on the problem of independence, building weapons and transport and shelters and the like. Now, that was a problem solved, and there they were, and an ice age was coming. Many of them had come to Da Vinci from his earlier terraforming effort and could be talked into returning to it, no doubt. But what to do? Well, Sabishi was 4 kilometers above the datum, and the Tirrhena Massif went up to 5. The scientists there were the best in the world at high-altitude ecology. So, a conference, another little utopia enacted. It was obvious. That afternoon, Sax stopped his rover in the saddle between Pavonis and Arcia at the spot called 4 Mountain View. A sublime place, with 2 of the continent volcanoes filling the horizons to north and south, and then the distant bump of Olympus Mons off to the northwest, and on clear days, this one was too hazy, a glimpse of Ascrius in the distance just to the right of Pavonis. In this spacious, sere highland, he ate his lunch, then turned east and drove down toward Nicosia to catch a flight to Da Vinci and then on to Sabishi. He had to spend a lot of screen time with the Da Vinci team and many other people on Pavonis trying to explain this move, reconciling them to his departure from the warehouse meetings. "I am in the warehouse in every sense that matters," he said. But they wouldn't accept that. Their cerebellums wanted him there in the flesh, a touching thought, in a way. Touching. A symbolic statement that was nevertheless quite literal. He laughed, but Nadia came on and said irritably, "Come on, Sax, you can't give up just because things are getting sticky. In fact, that's exactly when you're needed. You're General Sax now. You're the great scientist. You have to stay in the game." But Hiroko showed just how present an absent person could be, and he wanted to go to Sabishi. "But what should we do?" Nergal asked him, and others too, in less direct ways. The situation with the cable was at an impasse. On Earth, there was chaos. On Mars, there were still pockets of metanational resistance and other areas in red control where they were systematically tearing out all terraforming projects and much of the infrastructure as well.
There were also a variety of small revolutionary splinter movements that were taking this opportunity to assert their independence, sometimes over areas as small as a tent or a weather station.
Well, Sack said, thinking about all this as much as he could bear to, whoever controls the life support system is in charge. Social structure as life support system. Infrastructure. Mode of production. Maintenance. He really ought to speak to the folks at Séparation de l'Atmosphère and to the tent makers, many of whom had a close relation to Da Vinci, meaning that in certain senses he himself was as much in charge as anyone. A bad thought.
But what do you suggest we do? Maya demanded. Something in her voice made it clear she was repeating the question.
By now Sax was closing in on Nicosia, and impatiently he said, "Send a delegation to Earth, or convene a constitutional congress, and formulate a first approximation constitution, a working draft."
Maya shook her head. "That won't be easy with this crowd."
"Take the constitutions of the 20 or 30 most successful Terran countries," Sax suggested, thinking out loud, "and see how they work. Have an AI compile a composite document, perhaps, and see what it says."
"How would you define most successful?" Art asked.
"Country futures index, real values gauge, Costa Rica comparisons, even gross domestic product, why not?"
Economics was like psychology, a pseudoscience trying to hide that fact with intense theoretical hyper-elaboration. And gross domestic product was one of those unfortunate measurement concepts like inches or the British thermal unit that ought to have been retired long before. But what the hell?
"Use several different sets of criteria. Human welfare, ecological success, what have you."
"But Sax," Coyote complained, "the very concept of the nation-state is a bad one. That idea by itself will poison all those old constitutions."
"Could be," Sax said, "but as a starting point."
"All this is just sidestepping the problem of the cable," Jackie said.
It was strange how certain elements of the Greens were as obsessed by total independence as the radical Reds. Sax said, "In physics, I often bracket the problems I can't solve and try to work around them and see if they don't get solved retroactively, so to speak. To me, the cable looks like that kind of problem. Think of it as a reminder that Earth isn't going to go away."
But they ignored that, arguing as they were over what to do about the cable, what they might do about a new government, what to do about the Reds who had apparently abandoned the discussion, and so on and so forth, ignoring all his suggestions and getting back to their ongoing wrangles. So much for General Sax in the post-revolutionary world. Nicosia's airport was almost shut down, and yet Sax didn't want to go into the town. He ended up flying to Da Vinci with some friends of Spencer's from Dawes's Forked Bay, flying a big new ultralight they had built just before the revolt, in anticipation of the freedom from the need for stealth. As the AI pilot floated the big silver-winged craft over the great maze of Noctis Labyrinthus, the five passengers sat in a chamber on the bottom of the fuselage which had a large, clear floor so that they could look over the arms of their chairs at the view below. In this case, the immense linked network of troughs, which was the chandelier. Sax stared down at the smooth plateaus that stood between the canyons, often islanded. They looked like nice places to live, somewhat like Cairo there on the north rim, looking like a model town in a glass bottle. The plane's crew started talking about Séparation de l'Atmosphère, and Sax listened closely. Although these people had been concerned with the revolution's armaments and with basic materials research, while SEP, as they called it, had dealt with the more mundane world of mesocosm management, they still had a healthy respect for it.
Designing strong tents and keeping them functioning was a task with very severe consequences for failure, as one of them said. Criticalities everywhere, and every day a potential adventure. SEP was associated with Praxis, apparently, and each tent or covered canyon was run by a separate organization. They pooled information and shared roving consultants and construction teams. Since they deemed themselves necessary services, they ran on a cooperative basis, on the Mondragon plan, one said, non-profit version, though they made sure to provide their members with very nice living situations and lots of free time. They think they deserve it, too, because when something goes wrong, they have to act fast or else. Many of the covered canyons had had close calls, sometimes the result of meteor strike or other drama, other times more ordinary mechanical failures. The usual format for covered canyons had the physical plant consolidated at the higher end of the canyon, and this plant sucked in the appropriate amounts of nitrogen, oxygen, and trace gases from the surface winds. The proportions of gases and the pressure range they were kept at varied from mesocosm to mesocosm, but they averaged around 500 millibars, which gave some lift to the tent roofs, and was pretty much the norm for indoor spaces on Mars, in a kind of invocation of the eventual goal for the surface at the datum. On sunny days, however, the expansion of air inside the tents was very significant, and the standard procedures for dealing with it included simply releasing air back into the atmosphere, or else saving it by compressing it into huge container chambers hollowed out of the canyon cliffs. "So one time I was in Dal Valles," one of the techs said, "and the excess air chamber blew up, shattering the plateau and causing a big landslide that fell down onto Rule Gate and tore open the tent roof. Pressures dropped to the local ambient, which was about 260, and everything started to freeze, and they had the old emergency bulkheads," which were clear curtains only a few molecules thick but very strong, as Sachs recalled. "And when they deployed automatically around the break, this one woman got pinned to the ground by the super sticky at the bottom of the bulkhead with her head on the wrong side. We ran over to her and did some quick cut and paste and got her loose, but she almost died." Sachs shivered, thinking of his own recent brush with cold, and 260 millibars was the pressure one would find on the peak of Everest. The others were already talking about other famous blowouts, including the time Hiranyagarbha's dome had fallen in its entirety under an ice rain, despite which no one had died. Then they were descending over the great cratered high plain of Xanthi, coming down on the Da Vinci crater floor's big sandy runway, which they had just started using during the revolution. The whole community had been preparing for years for the day when stealthing would become unnecessary, and now a big curve of copper-mirrored windows had been installed in the arc of the southern crater rim. There was a layer of snow in the bottom of the crater, which the central knob broke out of quite dramatically. It was possible they could arrange for a lake in the crater floor with a central knob island, which would have as its horizon the circling cliffy hills of the crater rim. A circular canal could be built just under the rim cliffs, with radial canals connecting it to the inner lake. The resulting alternation of circular water and land would resemble Plato's description of Atlantis. In this configuration, Da Vinci could support, in near self-sufficiency, some 20 or 30,000 people, Sachs guessed. And there were scores of craters like Da Vinci. A commune of communes, each crater a city-state of sorts, its polis fully capable of supporting itself, of deciding what kind of culture it might have, and then with a vote in a global council of some kind. No regional association larger than the level of the town, except for arrangements of local interchange. Might it work? Da Vinci made it seem like it might. The south arc of the rim was alive with arcades and wedge-shaped pavilions and the like, now all shot through with sunlight. Sachs toured the whole complex one morning, visiting one lab after the next and congratulating the occupants on the success of their preparations for a smooth removal of Unta from Mars. Some political power came out of the end of a gun, after all, and some out of the look in the eye. And the look in the eye changed, depending on whether a gun was pointed at it or not. They had spiked the guns, these people, the Saxaclones, and so they were in high spirits, happy to see him and already looking for different work. Back to basic research or figuring out uses for the new materials that Spencer's alchemists were constantly churning out, or studying the terraforming problem. They were also paying attention to what was going on in space and on Earth. A fast shuttle from Earth, contents unknown, had contacted them requesting permission to make an orbital insertion without a keg of nails being thrown in its way. So a Da Vinci team was now nervously working out security protocols in heavy consultation with the Swiss embassy, which had taken an office in a suite of apartments at the northwest end of the Ark. From rebels to administrators, it was an awkward transition. "What political parties do we support?" Sachs asked. "I don't know. The usual array, I guess." "No party gets much support. Whatever works, you know." Sachs knew. That was the old tech position held ever since scientists had become a class in society, a priest caste almost, intervening between the people and their power. They were apolitical, supposedly, like civil servants, empiricists who only wanted things managed in a rational, scientific style, the greatest good for the greatest number, which ought to be fairly simple to arrange, if people were not so trapped in emotions, religions, governments, and other mass delusional systems of that sort. The standard scientist politics, in other words. Sachs had once tried to explain this outlook to Desmond, causing his friend, for some reason, to laugh prodigiously, even though it made perfect sense. Well, it was a bit naive, therefore a bit comical, he supposed. And like a lot of funny things, it could be that it was hilarious right up to the moment it turned horrible. Because it was an attitude that had kept scientists from going at politics in any useful way for centuries now. And dismal centuries they had been. But now they were on a planet where political power came out of the end of a mesocosm aerating fan. And the people in charge of that great gun, holding the elements at bay, were at least partly in charge, if they cared to exercise the power. Gently, Sachs reminded people of this when he visited them in their labs. And then to ease their discomfort with the idea of politics, he talked to them about the terraforming problem. And when he finally got ready to leave for Sabashii, about 60 of them were willing to come with him to see how things were going down there. "Sachs's alternative to Pavonis," he heard one of the lab techs describe the trip. Which was not a bad thought.
This ends side one of cassette 3. Please turn the cassette over and start side 2 at the same point.